CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time of the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it is Saturday, March 16th, 2024. A rare Ben Jarofsky Saturday recording. Everybody got up real early on a Saturday for us. My distinguished guest is not exactly an early riser herself. We're up early to do this recording. Give you a sense of what's going on in the world. This is a story we've been talking about a lot on this particular show, particularly with Monroe, Mark Wallace. And it has to do with, oh my goodness, Kim Fox. How many people have I had this conversation with about Fannie Willis? You could say I'm pretty obsessed with this particular conversation. So anyway, Fannie Willis is going to be allowed to continue prosecuting the case so long as her lover, paramour, boyfriend, office romance partner steps down from the case. Nathan Wade, that was the ruling by a judge in Atlanta. Complete and total and utter waste of my time, in my humble opinion. I've said this many, many times. The notion of an office romance being used to blow up prosecution of Donald Trump on very serious charges of trying to instigate a coup and steal an election is so absurd. It can only happen in MAGA land. And the typical liberals just like falling in line, so worried that they're going to look unfair to Donald Trump. They bend over backwards to appease him. Nate, are we still recording? Nate, are we still recording? I guess so. One, two. Anyway, they bend over backwards to appease Trump. And long and short of it, Fannie Willis gets to remain on the case. So MSNBC reported, and thank you, listener Frank, for sending me this text, that Judge Scott McAfee had written his order on Willis and Wade earlier last week. But because he had been receiving threats, he waited until today to make it public in order to allow for proper security to be in place for him and his family. Just think about that, ladies and gentlemen. If it had been any, just imagine if it was on the left, like threats against a judge so that the judge has to delay his ruling. The amount of violence that MAGA threatens, the amount of violence that MAGA represents, the refusal to acknowledge that Joe Biden won the last election, their support for an insurrection, the fact that they forced the Supreme Court to make an absolutely ridiculous ruling in Colorado. Like, our country is being intimidated. Our country is like afraid. We have judges who are afraid. We have jurors who are afraid. Prosecutors. You need extra security. I mean, I remember the wild days of the 60s. I was a kid. Like the Weathermen and all these leftist faction groups were used to scare and terrorize Americans. And I don't think it was anything as dangerous as MAGA right now. This judge gave MAGA essentially what it wanted, bent over backward to appease them. And he's still worried MAGA may come after him. It just underscores my feeling that the U.S. Supreme Court gave Trump the ruling in Colorado he wanted because they feared for their lives because of MAGA's violent tendencies. All right, I'm done with that. I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce herself, and away we go. Distinguished guest.
Hi, I'm Romana Hussein. I'm a member of the Sun-Times editorial board and a columnist at the newspaper as well.
Yes, columnist extraordinaire at the newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times. So, Romana, I would love to take a deep dive or a mini deep dive into what's been going on politically in our country with a coalition of Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans, Arab Americans in general, and lefties coming together to force President Biden to shift a little bit on his attitude toward Israel, Palestine, and the ongoing slaughter in Gaza. And we saw it. It's not just him, but the Democratic Party. Senator Charles Schumer yesterday, I think it was, I've lost track of time, made a speech in the Senate floor where he essentially called for Netanyahu to step down and for new elections in Israel, to have a new leader of that country, to have like a redo, if you will. It's kind of extraordinary for an older guy like me to see the change. It's a slow change. I guarantee you that, but it is a change. And I think that we have to acknowledge that this is a different attitude than's ever been, strongly articulated in this country before. And so I believe it's to a large degree because of this coalition that I just alluded to, pressuring Biden, particularly with the uncommitted votes in Michigan and Minnesota, and now here in Illinois, we're going to have a primary, and there's talk of a lot of people saying, I'm just not going to vote for president. You know, Biden's running unopposed here. I'm just not going to vote for president. This is send a message. Your thoughts on this subject?
Yeah, I obviously, being a member of the Muslim community, this has been, a lot of people have been upset by Biden's stance on the issue, on the bombing itself. You know, a lot of people feel like Joe Biden, on one hand, he's saying, you know, oh, okay, Israel, like, you need to calm down. And we're always hearing reports about Joe Biden behind closed doors is really mad at Netanyahu. Yet we keep sending weapons over there. Most of the bombs there are basically from our funding are from the United States, if I'm not mistaken. So I know my community has been very upset with the way Joe Biden has been handling the situation, the way he's been talking about it publicly. And so I think it was actually our paper, Sun-Times, Nader, Esau Linsweet had a story. It actually came out, I want to say, late night on Wednesday, because I remember seeing it, and one of my colleagues told me about it, and then I saw it. There was some representatives from Biden's administration who were in town, I believe, on Friday. It was Friday, I think, Thursday or Friday, but I'm pretty sure it was Friday. And there was a large contingent of Palestinian Muslims and other Arabs who refused to meet with Joe Biden because, you know, they were invited to meet with him. There, I have to tell you, Ben, there was a small group of people who did go end up speaking with these representatives. And there's been kind of a lot of back and forth. I know some of the names that are on there, and I do think that they had good intentions, but a lot of people, especially the Palestinian Americans, are like, that's not what we wanted. So there's been a lot of like discussion about whether they think it's right or wrong. A lot of people feel like it doesn't matter. The Biden administration has been reaching out. It's closer to election time. They feel it's a political stunt. And so they're like, why do we even have to go out and meet them? And this, as you know, happened in Michigan as well, when Biden came to talk to the, there's a large Arab American community in Michigan, as you know, in Dearborn. I think a lot of people refuse to meet with him there. So this is a pattern that we're seeing. Yeah, I think you are right, Ben. I mean, in a way, I mean, the needle has moved like an inch and it hadn't moved for like years. I felt like it moved a couple of centimeters a few years ago, but I think there's a lot of people speaking out about our blind support of Israel, including a lot of younger Jewish Americans. I think a lot of younger Americans in general, no matter the race. I mean, under 40, under 30, they're not with our blind support to Israel. And so I think what we're seeing, like in the larger community and larger like mainstream America, at least in the bigger cities, is people kind of rising up and they're saying that, you know, we need to speak out and Joe Biden needs to stop what he's doing. And so there's a lot of people, I think on Tuesday, I can tell you from what I know from my community, they don't want to vote for either Donald Trump or Joe Biden. We don't have an uncommitted option in Illinois like they did in Michigan. So a lot of people are just wondering, what do? We leave a blank? Do we write Free Palestine, Free Gaza, anything like, you know? So I'm just saying that there's been a lot of discussion. I don't know. In Chicago, obviously, Joe Biden is going to win. There's no question about that. But I don't know how many people are going to be leaving a blank. But I think there's going to be a significant number. And I don't know how it would work when we don't have these uncommitted ballots in Illinois, like how it would work if anybody would actually count to see how many people who, you know, got the Democratic ballot, how many of them did leave a blank. I don't know if they're going to be counting that. That's a question I have.
Well, I'll be geekily counting that. I'm obsessed with things.
How would you know that if nobody's actually counting it?
Well, you take you count the number of ballots taken, and then you'll be the guy that I contact. Yeah, I'll be the guy. Every election, I'm the guy up for hours doing deep dive counting and calibrating, and then calling your husband Mick, because he's pretty much the only guy I got in the world to talk to about this stuff, who's obsessed with it as I am. But I actually, in this particular instance, I do believe party insiders will be looking at it. My buddy Jacob Kaplan will probably be taking a look at this. You know, there's so much at play here, Ramana, and I'm going to say what I always say when I take this dive. When I talk about it, I always feel a little queasy when you do the political fallout over the war in the Middle East, the war in Gaza, and because it's a human rights thing. It's just like basic humanity. It's like people are starving and we got to get them supplies. We got to get them food and we got to end this crisis and emergency, medical emergencies, et cetera, and so forth. And just to do a political analysis at this moment is callous. But that's what's going on. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, Ramana. That's what's going on. And right now, I guarantee you, Biden election officials are trying to figure out if they can win this election with these patterns that we're seeing in like Minnesota and Michigan. They're probably most concerned about Michigan. I had a conversation with a guy named Andrew Ellison, who is a complete political geek, Ramana. He's just like me and Mick. And he studied the returns in Michigan, and he studied where the uncommitted votes were strongest, and he made analysis based on that. And there's a lot of factors at play here. So, like for instance, there's a lot of lefties, my beloved lefties, who are joining this uncommitted bandwagon, and hardcore lefties hate liberals almost as much as they hate MAGA. Ramana, and maybe they hate them more than they hate MAGA. Okay. And so hardcore lefties aren't going to vote for Joe Biden. There could be nothing going on in Gaza. It could have been just like everything was October 6th. And they still, like the hardcore lefties will be like, Ben, there's no difference between Trump and Biden. I'm like, I can't deal with you. I cannot deal with you to say there's no difference between Trump and Biden. You have left the real world and now you live in lefty land. Okay. I love lefty land too to a certain degree, but to go that far is really demented. And then there's Arab Americans in Michigan who already were moving conservative. You know, we're already being wooed by MAGA, particularly on issues like gay marriage just like the culture war issues. We saw that last year with the measure in Detroit regarding the gay flag, not to be, it was not to be on Hamtramck, not to be anywhere in public spaces. So there's all these other developments politically that are happening at the same time. And so I think the Biden people are trying to figure out if they can win the election without lefty voters, without young voters to a certain degree, without Arab or Muslim voters. I don't know if they could do it, Ramana. So you see what I'm saying? And that's where the political calculations come in. And they go, we better shore up our support among. And this has got nothing to do with right or wrong. If people do the right thing for the wrong reasons, what do you care as long as you're doing the right thing?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
But I feel like at the same time, it's like, how long is it going to take you to wake up that this is a human rights issue? You know what I mean? And so a lot of people, I can tell you, Ben, I'm not a political nerd like you and my husband Mick are, but it's week one into this, I told my husband, if Biden keeps this up, he's going to lose the Muslim and slash Arab vote. I can tell you that. And I remember having this argument with my husband, and he was just like, no, it's going to be, Biden's going to lose the vote, it's going to be, lose the election, it's going to be over the migrant issue. I'm like, no, this is going to become the issue. I'm telling you right now, this was like a week into it, because there was already like a lot of deaths within the first week. And we're like, if Joe Biden, after hugging Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, is like giving him a blank check, this is going to be bad. And so a lot of people feel like there's over 31,000 Palestinians who have died so far. The majority of these people are women and children. And not to say that a lot of the men who've died are innocent civilians too. You know, civilians too have nothing to do with what happened on October 7th. So, you know, it's just like weird what's happening in this country. There's definitely a lot of people who are saying like, this is a human rights issue. But then you have this group of people who are making it seem like you're a bad person if you don't want war in the Middle East and want the fighting to stop. You know, ceasefire has kind of become a dirty word in this country. And that's what's disturbing to me. And a lot of people are just using everything they can. It's like the mental gymnastics that they're doing in their minds to come up with a justification for doing this. It's just insane. So I'm just letting you know, I think, you know, I don't know anybody personally, at least in Chicago, I can tell you. I mean, I don't know. Some people, you know, might vote for Donald Trump from the Muslim community. I mean, we knew that there was people of color and Muslims who voted for him in 2020. There's always a large group of people from different, not large, but a certain segment of the population from all, you know, including Latinos who, you know, Donald Trump has also gone after, who voted for Donald Trump, which I don't think makes sense. I don't know anybody in Illinois. None of my friends would vote for Donald Trump, but they just feel like Joe Biden. They're like, okay. And then they're mad at liberals right now too, because a lot of liberals are like kind of wagging their fingers and saying, well, do you think Donald Trump likes you? And a lot of Arab and Palestinians and, you know, especially, you know, Muslims, but especially Arabs and Palestinians are pointing out, listen, he has no problem killing our counterparts and our relatives overseas. Do you think he cares about us either? So I think a lot of people feel like, okay, Donald Trump doesn't like us. We know that. But we're like, the Democrats act like they like us, but at the end of the day, they don't see us as real Americans. So there's just this feeling, and they feel like, you know, we have to stand up for ourselves and show the country that what we think does matter. Because they feel, a lot of Muslim people and a lot of, you know, people from the Middle Eastern, you know, Palestinian community feel like nothing that they've said has, if they feel like everything they've said, I should say, has gone in Joe Biden's ear and come out the other side. And so these discussions that they're having, I don't know, it's obviously largely political. Like you said, people sometimes do the right things for the wrong reasons, but how long is it going to take for them to finally tell Israel that, hey, maybe you need to stop? Like really, like publicly say this and not something said behind closed doors, because, you know, a lot of people are saying things like, well, America has nothing to do with it. And I think that's total bullshit. I think America, if we weren't behind this, it wouldn't be going on for this long.
In other words, if the United States wasn't just blindly sending aid to Israel, okay, that, it wouldn't be going on. Well, I got new. I have to say that the protests aren't going anywhere. The pressure on Biden isn't going anywhere. This week, there were plans announced for meetings to convene to discuss protests at the Democratic National Convention, which will be in Chicago. Despite my opposition, I wish it had gone to Atlanta. Just to show you how much influence I have, Romana. It's Biden's going to have to deal with this. And I can't underscore this point enough. In almost every time in our country when there's been a popular uprising, if you will, peaceful uprising, to try to force the powers that be to change the course that they're on. There's a moment of political reckoning when the powers that be weigh the consequence of continuing their programs or their positions against changing them. So in other words, if you continue, like think of the civil rights movement, if you continue to oppose civil rights, what will be the political consequences for that? You know what I'm saying? And so you could say, well, they don't mean it in their heart of hearts. And I just can't accentuate this point enough. It doesn't matter. We don't know what's in the heart of hearts of anybody anyway. What matters is you change. And I've watched this over the course of my life. Political uprisings, generally from the left or the black community, forcing the powers that be in this country to change. And it's a long, exhaustive process. And then the powers that be always deny that they're changing because of popular protest, because they don't want to encourage other people. This is really prevalent in Chicago, Romana. Just think about Rahm Emanuel and Kwame McDonald video, and then with the eruption that happened after that, and how his first, 6 years in office, he did nothing on the issue of police brutality. And all of a sudden he's like, oh yeah, this is an issue I must address. And it was because there were people in the streets. Yep. So this is a reality. This is a democracy. Well, at the moment it is, if Donald Trump is elected.
Yeah, true. And I wrote about this, Ben, last month. That was my whole thing. I wrote a column about how protests are never popular in America when they're actually being done. And people look at them like 30 years later, 20 years later, and they're like, oh, why were people like so against the protesters? And that's why I wrote about the pro-Palestinian protesters and the attitudes people have towards them. Not everybody, but a lot of attitudes that a lot of mainstream Americans have. And I've kind of found the study that said that Americans like protests and dissent when it's happening overseas. They're ready to cheer that on, but it's when in their own backyard and people are criticizing either American foreign policy or, you know, the way the status quo in America at the time, most people are upset. So, yeah, you're right, Ben. I think we just look at it from a different perspective when it's in our own country and people are calling out our own government and the way that they operate. So, yeah, you're totally right, Ben. You're right. And I have to tell you, I got credentialed for the DNC. So I'm probably going to go hang outside and see what the climate's going to be like, because that's what I'm interested in.
Well, you'll be representing the Ben Jarofsky show, because I am not going to be in town.
I'll be a correspondent for you. So
special correspondent for the Ben Jarofsky show. I want nothing to do with the Democratic National Convention on a whole bunch of fronts. So I'm not even going to be in town. I missed the one in 96 as well. I don't know if you remember that one.
I was there. That's when my first year when I started working as a journalist. I was working for City News. And I have to tell you, so, you know, I wanted to, you know, because the last time we had the Democratic Convention was 1968. I'm a Gen Xer. So we always remember the footage that was seen and we thought that was so cool. And we're like, oh, look, all these people protesting. And it was such a historic moment. So when it came in 96, I wasn't covering it. I was literally just started, but they all gave us a chance to go hang out there for a little bit because we wanted to see what the scene was like. So I went there for about an hour and I checked it out. So I definitely remember.
I always love it when Romana reminisces about something that happened before she was born, because I was very much alive in 1968. I remember it blew my mind, the 68 convention, in so many ways. It scared me. It was a frightening spectacle. And in many ways, Romana, it kind of illustrates the point that we're making right now, because How old was I? 12. For a 12-year-old kid in suburban Evanston, it was scary to see this uprising. You get what I'm saying? And like, kind of hippie scared me. And you know what I mean? I was 12.
Yeah. Oh yeah, okay. I had a teacher. This class I took, humanities. I mean, it was the coolest class. And the teacher, we talked about the 60s. We read Malcolm X. I mean, which was really rare. Like my Mick never heard of Malcolm X until he was in his 20s. I heard about Malcolm X when I was in a teenager. It was because of this teacher that we had. And he basically had told us that, you know, he was never a hippie. The average person wasn't a hippie. And that's where we learned that.
That is so wild, man. I don't know what to say about that. We'll put that one aside. Wow. But anyway, when the police started beating the hell out of the protesters, that scared me too. I'm like, what's going on? So it's like these moments. And then, of course, that led in many ways to Richard Nixon's election in 68 against Hubert Humphrey, which really in many ways set the country back. I mean, there's consequences to our, when our leaders like lead us into wars, like the Vietnam War, in the face of massive protests and opposition, there are political consequences, duh. And just similarly here with what's going, blind support for Israel in the face of what's going on in Gaza, there's going to be political consequences. There's going to be a political fallout. So we just have to somehow get through this moment. All right, let's move on from this conversation and move to something I was going to say a little lighter, but in many ways, it's not. And that is, we're going to do the Oscars, the Academy Awards. Romana and I are fans of the Oscars, and I know it happened a week ago, but this is our first opportunity to talk about it. And on a similar front, you and I were both, I thought you would write a column about this, but you went in a different direction. That's fine. So Jonathan Glazer, great director, directed a movie called Zone of Interest, what was the award? I can't remember what the award it was for.
Best foreign film. Because he's British. The guy's British.
He's British, right. Yeah. For a moment, I just blanked on one. And it's a haunting film. It's a very challenging film. It's about the German family of the commandant who ran Auschwitz. And so it's really about our ability as human beings to turn our face away from the most horrific acts of cruelty and barbarism and slaughter. And so it's, in a way, it's about a very specific event, Romana, but it's a parable, and it, as such, it could be applied to many different events, including what's going on right now, or what's going on many times. Romana has been on the show to talk about, this is one of her favorite themes, like slaughters and atrocities in foreign countries that Americans pay no attention to all the time. We don't even know they're going. I mean, at least we're aware of what's happening at Gaza. So he got up and he gave a speech where he essentially said, I do not want my horror at the Holocaust and my Judaism to be used as a justification for the ongoing slaughter in Gaza. I thought it was a very courageous speech, actually. I was watching with a bunch of young lefties, and they all applauded. My beloved lefties. But, man, the blowback from many people in the Jewish community was really disturbing and upsetting, because they misquoted the guy. You know, he said, They said he refuted his Judaism. He didn't do that at all. And it just kind of drove home the point of how raw this issue is and how divided people are on this issue and how people are incapable, because of the power of their feelings, and are incapable of seeing the humanity in Palestinians. And I know just saying this, there's going to be people mad at me for saying this. But is that the point that Glaser was making, Romana, was that it's very similar to, in some respects, the attitudes of Germans. Like, they just didn't see the humanity in the people that were getting slaughtered by the Nazis. And it wasn't just Jews. I mean, it was a wider range of people who were slaughtered by the Nazis. And so people don't see their humanity in them. They don't regard them as real people. And so if it's like gypsies, or if it's homosexuals, or if it's just leftists in general, you don't regard them as real human beings. You don't care that they're getting slaughtered. You go on with your life. That was the point he was making. And yet he was just attacked, reviled, hated on. I found it an upsetting moment, to put it mildly. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I did too. I mean, after like how some people are kind of following me and criticizing me for what my stance is on the situation through my columns, I did not want to touch this because this was a Jewish man who said that, and there were some Jewish people who were angry about it. Obviously, he has a lot of Jewish supporters too. But there was a lot of people, Ben, as we've mentioned before, right-wing Christians who were just going berserk and like criticizing him. And I was like, this is partly why I don't want to like weigh in on it, even though I have a stance on it. But they, you know, it's like, who are you to tell this guy that he can't use his Jewishness to talk about how what's happening in Gaza is wrong? It was just kind of crazy. I'm not scared of touching it, but I just needed a break for my own mental health. But that's the whole thing, Ben. I told you in 2022 when I went to Poland with my younger sister and a friend, we actually went to Auschwitz. We did it's an educational tour over there, and it's depressing. I mean, it is so depressing just being there. And I remember we were just like, just so sad after we left. And, you know, that's the whole thing. When people say never again, it means everybody, right? We shouldn't let, you know, people just killing people for no, you know, and at this point you can argue that what Israel's doing, it is indiscriminate bombing in a lot of people's viewpoints, because there's a lot of people who had nothing to do with October 7th who are being killed. So it's collective punishment. And, you know, it's a different situation, obviously. People aren't being put in concentration camps, but it's like there's a certain group of people that are being targeted. And so I thought the speech was really powerful, too, when I heard it. I mean, sadly, he said the right thing. And it's supposed to be brave, right? Because he said the right thing. But, you know, people were just taking his quote out of context. And, you know, during World War II, when Jewish people and others, as you mentioned, Ben, because, yeah, when I went to Auschwitz, I remember they told us all the different other groups that were there, too, including people who were like the gypsies, people who were homosexuals. There's all kinds of people there. But the majority of people there were Jewish. And it's just so depressing that people kind of turned their backs to it. And at the time, I started Googling like about Auschwitz. And I remember at the same time while I was there, there were some newly released photos that came out of people in Germany who were at Auschwitz, and they made it into like a holiday. Like they were just sitting there enjoying themselves, getting a suntan, you know, playing with their kids on the actual ground of Auschwitz while all these atrocities were happening. And it is kind of crazy, right, that happened. But I know we're not really in the backyard. We're not sitting in Gaza watching this. But a lot of the ways people can ignore some of this stuff is similar. And, you know, there's other atrocities happening right now, too. That's one of the things. This is the one that we're actually paying attention to because Israel is our major ally. But there's something, there's a war going on, or at least death and destruction in Sudan. There's like so many different, you know, there's so many different situations throughout the world where we don't pay attention to, and there's people that are just dying. And then we read about it later or we don't hear about it. It's, you know, it's not to say that it's not being covered because people are obviously covering it. That's why we know about it. But it's like what we are highlighting is, you know, we don't see it necessarily. We don't see Sudan on the front page of our news. We have a large Palestinian population here. We have a large Jewish population, a lot of supporters of Israel. So this is something that we're even paying attention to. And I think even then, we're not covering every single thing that's happening, that's been happened in these past 5 months. So no, I thought that speech was really good. I still have to see Zone of Interest. I do want to watch it. I thought his speech was really good. I just think it's sad that people took his quote out of context when he was trying to say the right thing and people are just going after him. But I think there's been a lot of columns and articles written in defense of him by a lot of Jewish Americans saying that that was one of the bravest things anybody could have done. There were people wearing ceasefire pins. I don't know if you saw at the Oscars, there's a couple actors, Rami Youssef. Then there was Mark Ruffalo. Billie Eilish was wearing one too. There was a major protest literally outside of the Oscars at the time that it happened. So I thought it was a good speech. I was actually considering writing about it, but then I saw so many. I wasn't really scared. I shouldn't say that, but I just wanted to do something light or something, just kind of like just step away from it for a month. But I felt like a lot of people did write about it and they wrote exactly what I felt. And so I thought I was really good. I watched the Oscars by myself because, as you know, Ben, I was in Texas. I was on my way back. And so I just sat there and watched it on my iPad in my bed. Even so, even if I was here in Chicago, Mick would never watch it with me. So I'd have to watch it by myself and cheer it on or watch it with friends. But I watched it alone, fast forwarded the commercials and was able to get all the highlights.
So, all right, we might as well like go a little lighter here with the your Oscar reflections. Did you have a moment that stands out? I think you mentioned to me the Sean Lennon moment.
Yeah, I just I had no idea that John Lennon and Yoko Ono, the music that they made inspired a short film about peace. And so I'm like, oh, there's Sean Lennon. And so like, I'm a Beatles fan. So I'm like, oh, I'm like, maybe I should watch this movie. And then Sean Lennon talked and he gave a shout out to his mom. It was Mother's Day in England, or it was a day before. And he, God, I can't believe that Yoko Ono is like 91 years old. It's insane. So yeah. I thought that was cool. I feel like the Beatles, like, even if people don't want them to go away, they still show up in some way. So I thought that was pretty cool. Obviously, I saw like a lot of people chattering on Twitter. So seeing Slash show up during Ryan Gosling's song of I'm Ken, that was like, oh, there's Slash from Guns N' Roses. I was a big Guns N' Roses fan. I still like Guns N' Roses. I saw them when I was in college. And I was really young. So I thought that was cool that Slash turned up. I'm trying to think. I didn't think any of the fashions really stood out for me, but that's me. I was a little bummed that Killers of the Flower Moon didn't get any sort of nod. I still have to watch Poor Things, but I've been hearing mixed reviews about it, especially from women. So I don't know. I'll probably watch it eventually. But everything else I watched, I kind of wish The Holdovers got more awards. Oppenheimer seemed to be the movie of the day. It was a good movie, but I thought there was a lot of other good movies this year actually too.
Wow. I mean, Oppenheimer was, people hating on Oppenheimer. We talked about the flaws in Oppenheimer, yeah. How it overlooked, the Native Americans who lived in the area were Mexican Americans, you know what I mean? But man, as just a movie, what the man did to make that movie, just the scale of it, and to explore the themes that it explored, I'm not hating on Oppenheimer.
No,
I want to watch it again.
No, it was a good movie, and I'm not hating on it. I'm just saying. I mean, the best supporting actress from The Holdovers got an award. So I'm just saying that I was kind of hoping for some other, but I liked Oppenheimer too. You know, I had my beef with it. I was talking to Mick about it the other day. I'm like, I've heard a lot of criticism, you know, about the effects that it had, you know, them testing the bomb. I kind of wanted some sort of blurb at the end saying how many Japanese people were killed from the bomb and the effects of it. Because I know that was the whole point. You don't want to show it. I mean, they show him watching a footage. They show him watching footage and kind of reacting to it. So you know that, you know, he had some sort of reaction to it. That was kind of like, and I guess some people are saying that you don't have to show it. It's like, that's the whole thing. Like, you know, we were so removed from it. Like, it's easy for us to be like, oh, yay, and be like in a different part of the world and not realizing what, when you make a bomb, what it's going to be used for. So no, I thought the acting, Cillian Murphy, I think that's how you say his name. I think he's a great actor. I've seen him in movies for a long time. I think he deserved the Oscar. I think he's a great actor. So no, I mean, I like the movie. I'm just saying, I felt like there were some other movies that could have been recognized. I don't know if you saw that one movie, Society of Snow. I thought that was a great foreign film. That's based on the soccer players that crashed. I forgot which South American country it was. They had an American version of the movie in the 90s. Ethan Hawke was in it. It was called Alive. It's like a great movie, but I think you should watch that. I think I told you to watch that.
Yeah, you did. You recommended
so
that.
So Mick,
yeah.
It was really funny because Mick is like, I told him about the movie. I'm like, it's about this plane crash and they kind of have to resort to cannibalism and to survive. And Mick's like, I don't want to see this movie. He's like, he's always like so skeptical about so many movies. And he was like, and it's actually a very uplift, you know, it's very sad, but it's also uplifting too, because it kind of shows you the power of, you know, banding together and community and, you know, trying to survive. It's just an amazing story. The fact that it's a real life story is just, it's just incredible. I remember I was moved by it in the 90s and that was the Americans, but I think this one is, this movie is a lot better. It's like, you have to read subtitles, Ben, sorry, but it's an amazing movie. No, because I remember you said you don't like reading subtitles, or you said that you told me not to, you thought I didn't like to read subtitles. I actually
don't watch movies. I don't watch anything anymore without, they call them closed captions, but everything is American TV shows that I watch, my wife, like Bosch, we're obsessed with Bosch. Everything's subtitled.
Yeah, I do too, because sometimes you don't understand what people are saying because they say it so fast. And if you're watching something British, Mick and I watch this like British series called One Day. I'm going to tell Mick before I started, I'm like, oh, they're British. So I'm going to put this on. I'm going to put the subtitles on, because sometimes they'll say things and they'll just kind of like, wait, what did they say? Did they say this? And so, no, I watch it with closed captions too. But I'm just saying this is a foreign film. And I think you'd really like it.
So, all right, I'm going to do a baby rant, not a, like a full blown rant like I began with, and about the Oscars. And this is my rant. So as Ramona knows, I'm a huge fan of a novelist named Percival Everett. He's maybe up there with Kurt Vonnegut as one of my favorite authors. Like, if they write something, I read it. Kurt Vonnegut passed, of course, but Percival Everett is still very much alive. In 2002, he wrote a novel called Erasure. Which 20 years later was made into a movie called American Fiction. And Percival Everett has always been sort of on the fringes of popular culture because, as Ramona has discovered, he's kind of an eccentric, quirky writer. He's completely unafraid to break all kinds of conventions, both in his style and his subject. So up till now, he's never been a hugely popular best-selling writer. But anyway, Cord Jefferson read Erasure and turned it into a movie, American Fiction, and was the recipient at the Oscars of the Best Adapted Screenplay for American Fiction. And so he got up, he gave a speech, a very compelling speech about how he feels like it's about time that Hollywood recognizes stories and voices that they've ignored for so long. And he feels like him winning this Oscar symbolizes a change, and perhaps a Hollywood will now fund movies like the one he made, smaller movies that shine a spotlight or give an amplification to people and voices that have never been ignored. And I'm watching this going, yeah. Where's the shout out to Percival Everett coming? Where's the shout out? No shout out to Percival. I'm like, wait a minute. Here you are complaining how Hollywood ignores the voices that are always, and you didn't even give a shout out to Percival Everett. So I immediately texted that to absolutely everyone I know who shares my love for Percival Everett. It's not a really long list. It's Ramona and Rachel Hinton. But so, so that was my my rant.
No, it's a good point. Yeah. I want to read his new book called James. I mean, it's supposed to be a masterpiece. So
it really is. And we're going to do the deep dive. We're going to have a book club on our show for James. I've ordered it. Rachel Hinton has ordered it. Ramana's going to read it. It's the story of Huckleberry Finn told from the point of view of Jim. So it should be a pretty compelling read. The man's a genius, in my humble opinion, Percival Everett. Even if he is a little unconventional or quirky and what have you. So anyway, before we go, One Day? I didn't even heard of it. What is One Day?
Oh, that's really funny that you mentioned it. Like, on the weekend of Valentine's Day, I wanted to watch this this Korean movie film called Old Boy that a friend of mine, a Korean American friend, recommended. And it's a good thing we didn't see it mix, like, because I saw it yesterday and it wasn't a Valentine's Day selection. But anyway, Mick is like, I want to see a romance. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I remember I heard about this show. It's called One Day. And the woman is Indian and the guy is white. So I told Mick, I'm like, well, there's a show called One Day. It's a romance, but it's kind of a tearjerker. And do you want to watch it? And Mick got really into it. Like, it basically shows, like, it starts in 1988. This girl and guy meet on the last day of college, like at a party. And it kind of shows them throughout the years on that day, July something, for the next like 7, 8. Well, I forgot how many years it goes up to, but I think it goes up to 2003. And Mick was really into it. I told him the soundtrack was really good, and he was totally into it. It was pretty funny. He was more into it than I was, because my complaint was, so they had an Indian woman in it. Originally in the book, the woman is not Indian, but so they kind of had colorblind casting. And so there's no reference. Like, she never talks about being Indian in it at all. So it's like she talks about it once. Like, you know, she says her mother's Hindu and her dad's a lapsed Catholic, and then never again. It's like, I was like, I don't see that happening. And then Mick's like, well, I think they just didn't. I'm like, they should have embellished the script and, like, you know, at least touched upon it. But I thought the two leads are really good. I think so. One of the lead guy in it was in the second season of White Lotus. He was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like, so it's if you like romance, and it's a cute show. I told you my beef with it. I felt like they didn't show that much about this woman's family. It was more like the guy's story. So I was like, they didn't even talk about the Indian woman's family or anything. They didn't talk about her Indianness. And I was like, there's no way. I go, Mick, I talk about being Indian with you all the time and how I'm so different than you because I'm Indian all the time. So, but I think you might like it.
I will watch it. That's a classic Ramana criticism, by the way. If anyone can remember her critique of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, not enough attention paid to women. All he was obsessed with was Sharon Tate's feet. Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's the greatest movie. What are you talking about?
That's with my problem with Oppenheimer too. Like, women. Well, I just don't. You know, have you ever heard of the Bechdel test? It's basically if a movie has women in it talking, it's like a test to see how much women are put in a movie where they don't talk about a man or are talking with another woman, not talking about a man. And it's a pretty cool test. Most movies don't pass the Bechdel test because a lot of movies, well, Oppenheimer, it was like the only two characters in it were his like girlfriends, girlfriend or wife, and they barely said anything. Yeah. And there was a scientist, but she barely said anything. So I think you know, a lot of movies don't, you know, when they're especially made by men, they just kind of get female characters very wrong. And there's this Twitter feed that I follow called Men Writing Women. And it kind of takes passages from authors who describe women in their books. And they're all so funny. It's a really funny thing. So that's just my criticism about the film, because they did make this Indian character like very rich. But it's like, I think they could have went into a deeper dive with her.
Okay, so now we're into one of my favorite topics of criticism of Hollywood movies or movies in general. And I cannot stand, this is in TV shows too. this cliche, and to keep some kind of drama going in a movie, keep your interest, have a sense of conflict, they create what I call the wimpy spouse. And the wimpy spouse, it doesn't have to be a wife, a woman. It could be the husband. It could be a gay couple. It doesn't matter. It's always the wimpy spouse. So in Oppenheimer, you're absolutely correct. Every woman is reduced to a wimpy spouse or girlfriend who's like, this guy's trying to build the bomb that's going to save the world from Nazism. And she's like, ah, who's going to pick up the kids? And then I'll do wimpy spouse from She Said. So this is like these intrepid New York Times investigative reporters are digging out the truth of Harvey Weinstein and how he's like this rapist and stuff. And the wimpy husband is like, I had to put the children to bed. Oh, poor me. Come on. God damn. First of all, putting kids to bed is fun. You're such a wimp. And it's such a conventional. The wimpy spouse, man. Now you guys know about it. Your eyes will be open. Oppenheimer. Maestro. Did you see Maestro?
No, I have to still watch it. Mick doesn't want to watch it. And I want to watch it because it got nominated and I just thought I should watch it.
You should watch it.
I'll watch it on my own. I'll probably watch it on my own.
Yeah. But what a wimpy spouse. That's a total wimpy. The wife. Poor me.
Well, they play the victim. They play the victim, man.
Oh God! I just don't get me started in the wimpy spot. By the way, I'm going to close with a shout out to me. We've been teasing Mick Dumke. He was a guest. This is the Ramona and Mick weekend on the Ben Jarofsky Show. I interviewed them both, or conversations with them both. They both dropped. Mick Dumke wrote an absolutely sensational article for Black Club. I urge everybody to read it. It's about the life and times of Fred Mitchell, unknown. Chicago, who passed a couple months ago, who came to Chicago in the 30s, part of the Great Migration, was active in the Democratic Party as a reformer, as an agitator, and an entrepreneur and a businessman. And it's his story, just tells a story of Black people in Chicago from like the 40s into this century. Absolutely compelling piece. Shout out, Mick. You may be a wimp when it comes to movies, but you're a heck of a writer and a great journalist. And I just absolutely urge everybody to read Mick Dumke's Black Club story about Fred Mitchell. And then when you're done with that, listen to Mick and me talk about it. So I had to give that shout out to me. We tease him a lot on this show, Ramona, but
yeah, I think we take it easy on him. I could go harder if I want, but I'm being nice.
You're being nice because you know you don't want to be the wimpy spouse.
No.
There are no wimpy spouses in the Dumke Hussein household. No. By the way, no wimpy spouses. All right, Ramona, thank you very much. Appreciate it, and talk to you real soon. All right.
Okay. Talk to you later.
That's Ramona Hussein. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.